I wanted to talk about a couple of introductory topics to really help us understand the culture of Ashkenaz when it began in the medieval period. And maybe I'll begin with a story, a really fascinating story, a modern story. In the year 2013, in the city of Erfurt in Germany, the center of this country, they were going to be building a parking lot. And the parking lot was going to be built on the site of an old warehouse. Now, the local state archaeologists knew that where the warehouse was standing was actually an ancient Jewish cemetery. And when she found out that they had already knocked down the building and they were ready to build the parking lot, so she asked for 2 days. So she came, and she says that when she came there the first day, they were already putting in the foundation. They didn't listen. They were already putting in the foundation. She stopped them. She brought workers. And they found 48 skeletal remains, all lined up, one next to each other, so clearly having been buried in a cemetery. And they extracted all 48. They worked around the clock, and they extracted 48 skeletal remains of what seemed to have been the ancient medieval Jewish cemetery in Erfurt. The goal was to do some testing in order to figure out which bones were with, to make sure all the bones were correctly identified, and then to bring them to Kever Yisrael to have a proper burial in some other area of the city. However, there was bureaucracy and other things came up, and it ended up that those skeletal remains sat in a box until 2019. Now, we all know that in the past few years, there's been a real proliferation of DNA research. I myself took a DNA test. You can mail it away. Actually, in Israel, you're not allowed to do it. You have to do it in America or some place outside of Israel. But for $50, you can find out your DNA profile. So I myself did it. My grandmother did it. We had a bunch of people in the family do it. It's interesting to see your DNA profile. So in 2019, when finally somebody woke up and decided we need to do something with the skeletal remains, this same archaeologist said, I'd like to first do some DNA research on the bodies before we bury them. The rabbi of Erfurt found out about this, and he said, no way, you can't touch the bodies. The bodies need to be buried. We don't start chopping up bodies for scientific research. The question went to a Rav in Eretz Yisrael, and he ruled that if there are any teeth that are no longer connected to the body, they have a different status than the rest of the body, they can be analyzed. So she looked and she saw, or maybe she made sure that it would happen, that she was able to get teeth samples from almost all of the bodies, from 42 or 43 out of the 48 bodies. And the result of her studies really had a major impact on how we understand the origin of the Ashkenazi community here in the Rhineland. So before we find out what the result was, let's take a step back and understand what is Ashkenazi Jewry, how did it begin, and what are its roots right here in the Rhine Valley. So first of all, the term Ashkenaz comes up in Sefer Bereishis as a great-grandson of Noach. There's no real connection, seemingly, between the region that we refer to as Ashkenaz, this area, and the great-grandson of Noach. The researchers think that the great-grandson of Noach, where he ended up living with his family, was probably more in the Caucasus, near modern-day Georgia, not in this area. So how this area became Ashkenaz is an interesting question. But what do we know about the communities that lived here? Before the Holocaust, 92% of Jews were Ashkenazi. So where did Ashkenaz come from, and when did it begin? So the answer is we don't really know exactly when it began. There is a famous tradition that was well known in Ashkenaz and started in the 17th century. At least that's the first time that we see it recorded. I think many modern Jews know about it because the Art Scroll Siddur included it in their footnotes in their keynotes for Tisha B'Av. But there's this old record that there was a Jewish community here even in the times of the first Beis HaMikdash. Now that's very hard to accept, because this area was probably very, very, it was extremely remote at that time. But that's the tradition, that there was a community here even during the times of the first Beis HaMikdash. And when the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and then it was rebuilt, Ezra sent a letter to the communities of the Rhineland, begging them to come back, Shivat Zion, to come back to Israel, and they refused. And later, the great rabbis of the Rhineland would say that the reason why the Jews suffer during the Crusades so harshly is because they didn't take up the offer of Ezra to come back to Eretz Yisrael. Now it's interesting, there happens to also be in Teman, Yemen. In Yemen, the Yemenite community also has a tradition that they were invited by Ezra and they didn't listen, and that's the reason why they suffered later. And the Iranian community has a similar tradition. So this seems to be a very common Jewish tradition. We have it recorded in the 17th century, which is very late if we're talking about the first Beis HaMikdash time period. So that we should mention that first. That is an old Jewish tradition. Another more documented research about the Ashkenazi community is Josephus. Josephus writes that when the second Beis HaMikdash was being destroyed, tens of thousands of Jews were taken as slaves to Italy and settled as slaves, but then eventually spread out around Italy. This is after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. Now, in terms of outside sources, we actually have a very fascinating document. Constantine was the emperor of Rome. Constantine is famous for bringing Christianity to the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, for hundreds of years, was a pagan culture. And Constantine's mother was taken with Christianity, and she convinced him to bring Christianity to the Roman Empire. The truth is, he didn't make it the official religion. Up until Constantine, Christians were actually persecuted in the Roman Empire. Constantine was the one who made it an official or an accepted religion. It was later, Theodosius, around 50 years later, was another emperor. He made it the official religion of the Roman Empire. Now, in a document that we have from the period of Theodosius, he says that Constantine gave special tax rights to the Jews of the Rhine Valley. So we don't know how large that community was, but this is a document from the 4th century, really, the 300s, that is documenting a Jewish community here. And the assumption is that the Jews settled in Italy, they spread out, they went north looking, first of all, to be away from the center of the Roman Empire. If you're Jewish and the Roman Empire has become Christian, so you'd like to be as far away from the center of the action. Plus, Jews are always looking for economic opportunities. So they spread, as we see, it's a very beautiful area, it's a very lush area. And the Jews, perhaps in the 300s and the 400s, they moved to this area. However, at that point, we don't hear about them for another 500 years. When's the next time we hear about them? We hear about them during the time period of Charlemagne. Charlemagne, the Frankish king, he was in the area that's now, it was at the time, was called Gaul, France, Germany. He had a united kingdom, meaning the Roman Empire. It split a few times. It came back together. It was back to its original glory. And Charlemagne also has a charter. He invites the Jews to come and to settle in the cities that we're going to be talking about a lot over the next few days, like Mainz and Worms. Speyer was probably not yet a Jewish city at that time. And Charlemagne, that we're talking about now around the 800s, the 900s, Charlemagne invites the Jews back. Now, what happened to the Jews between 300 and 900? The assumption is that when the Roman Empire crumbled, how did the Roman Empire crumble? From this entire area of Germany going east into Poland, that whole area was barbarian. There were tribes, nomadic tribes, and those nomadic tribes, famous names like the Vandals, the Gauls, the Anglo-Saxons, these tribes penetrated into the Roman Empire and eventually sacked Rome and destroyed the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire would come back in a number of iterations, but when they crossed the Rhine River, that was a major step in the fall of the Roman Empire. And the assumption is that the Jews left with the Roman soldiers. When the Romans left the area, the Jews left. So what do we know? Again, let's just review. We know the Jews were here in the 300s. We know that when the Roman Empire crumbled in the 400s, they probably left with the Roman soldiers. But they were invited back in the 700s or 800s. There's a famous story of a family called the Colonimus family. The Colonimus family was a very well-respected family in Italy. They were invited to come to the Rhineland area, to the Rhine Valley, and to lead the Jewish community. And indeed, we know for the next 200 or 300 years, when we read Crusade Chronicles, the first Crusade was in 1096. When we read Crusade Chronicles, we hear a lot about the Colonimus family. The Colonimus family was a major Ashkenazic family. One of the reasons why this is so fascinating is because eventually the Jews had to leave Germany. Germany, as many of us are probably familiar, does not just have a 75-year history of persecuting Jews, but it's really a thousands of year history. Ever since the Jews were here, they were unfortunately being persecuted. And when the Jews, the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of the Jews in Germany was during the Black Plague in the 1350s. When the Black Plague struck Europe, the Jews were blamed that they had poisoned the wells, even though they were drinking from the same wells that everybody else was drinking from. But they were blamed for poisoning the wells, and there were major pogroms. We call them pogroms. Pogrom is really a Russian term for what took place in the Russian Empire 100 years ago. But we use the term pogroms. There was persecution and pogroms. And the Jews left Germany and they went east, into Poland. Here's the really interesting question. How is it possible, in Poland, there were millions and millions of Jews. How did these few cities in Germany produce millions and millions of Jews? And the truth is, we're always very taken, for instance, about what's taken place in Eretz Yisrael just over the past 70, 80 years. We see such a proliferation of Jews. The truth is, if you look throughout Jewish history, Jews were always blessed by God that they proliferated and that they were successful. It was perhaps the promise that Hashem said to them in Mitzrayim, that the more they'd be persecuted, the more that they would grow. So how did there become to be millions and millions of Jews in Eastern Europe? The assumption has always been that they came from Germany. So if we trace the Jews, how did the Jews get to Poland, all of these Ashkenazic Jews, 92% of Jewry before the Holocaust? The assumption is that they were originally from the land of Israel. Many went to Italy. Those who didn't go to Italy went to Bavel. And when Bavel also began to crumble, the Jews went from Bavel, also went into Europe. And from Western Europe, from Germany, they went over to Poland. I would add, many of us, we might have heard, it's a theory that was made popular in French intellectual circles in the late 1800s. It actually began over 100 years ago, but it's continued to be popular even in the 1970s. A book was put out that reignited this entire theory. What's the theory I'm talking about? That the Ashkenazic Jews of Eastern Europe did not come from Germany, who originally came from Italy, who originally came from Israel, but rather they came from the other direction. They came from the east. They came from the Khazar kingdoms. They came from the Balkans. They came from Turkey. They were Jewish converts. The story of the Khuzars, many of us might be familiar with the Sefer Khuzari, where the king of the Khuzars is having a religious awakening and he wants to leave paganism, and he invites a Christian and he invites a Jew and he invites a Muslim to present their religions. And what happens? The Khuzar king chooses Judaism and his entire kingdom converts. Now, there isn't so much historical record to prove that that actually happened, but what we do know is that many peoples from Turkey converted to Judaism. So some wanted to suggest, and this is a very popular theory amongst the Palestinians, that the Jews, the Ashkenazi Jews that make up such a large part of the Jewish population, are really converts from the East. They don't have their roots in Israel. And this is obviously a very politically sensitive theory, because if you could prove that all the Ashkenazi Jews are not originally from Israel, but they really come from converts from Turkey, so there's no ancestral claim to Israel by the Ashkenazi Jews. So what does the DNA research tell us? The DNA research came out in an article. It was published first in a peer-reviewed article, and then it was published in the New York Times. In 2020, the results of those teeth that had been taken and analyzed came out, and two amazing things were seen in the research. Number one, all of those Jews from Erfurt shared DNA with Italian and Middle Eastern populations, which supports what was always the Jewish understanding of where the Ashkenazi community came from. It came from Italy, that had started in the land of Israel, from the Middle East to Italy to Germany. What was also really fascinating, and this is what's called by genealogists a genealogical bottleneck, the study argues that all Ashkenazi Jews today can trace their lineage back to four women that lived in the 9th or 10th century. That is the theory of current DNA research. Four Ashkenazi women. Now, what does that mean? All Ashkenazi Jews. I told you I did my own DNA research. So I am 82% Ashkenazi Jewry. I have some North African Jewry in me. I have some Middle Eastern Jewry in me. I have some Italian Jewry in me. But I am 82% Germany, Polish, Ashkenazi Jewry, which means, according to this theory, that 82% comes from one of these four women. It's an amazing statistic that four women could produce millions and millions of people. It really helps us understand what Chazal tell us, that when a person saves the life of one person, he's mekayim an olam mele, and the loss of one person is like the destruction of an olam mele. This is where the Ashkenazic Jewry came from, and it settled here in the Rhineland, and as we said, it proliferated with tremendous numbers, and it spread to the east, and eventually led to the very powerful and significant Ashkenazi community that we're all familiar with. Just a couple of more minutes that we have, I wanted to also just relate to what was it like to be a Jew in Ashkenaz in medieval times. And what we have to understand in order to really get into the head of what it means to be an Ashkenazi Jew, we have to understand a little bit about the general culture of the time. There was no such thing at the time of being a private citizen. Right? Nowadays, we each have our own tu'udat zehut, or we have our own social security number, we have our own private life, our medical records, our home. In medieval times, there was no such thing as being a private citizen. You had to be part of a group of society. And the way that society in the medieval times, in this area, was broken up, in the system of feudalism, there were lords, there were kings, and lords and dukes, and then there were the serfs and the peasants that worked the fields. What was the nature of that relationship? Well, it was very simple. The dukes and the kings and the lords, they owned the land. They had serfs and peasants who lived on their land. The dukes and the lords would protect the serfs, the illiterate serfs. And in return, the serfs would pay a tax to the lords. And if need be, they would take up arms to defend the land of the lords. That was the relationship. That was one structure of society in medieval times. There was another structure, and that was the church. And the church worked in a very similar way. There was an upper class, bishops, priests, the pope, and then there were all of the commoners. And in a very similar way to feudalism, the church leaders provided a service for the simple people, religious services, and all different types of communion and different types of Christian services, and in return, the people would pay a tax. So where do the Jews fit into medieval society? They're not illiterate serfs. They certainly can't be lords. They're not Christians. And the answer is, they don't really fit in. So why were they here? They were here for a very simple reason. Because the Christians wanted them here. Why did the Christians want them here? Well, first of all, they were literate. They knew mathematics. They were connected to other Jews in other regions, and they trusted each other, and they worked together, and that meant that they could do business for you. But even more importantly, and you need to know a little bit of the halachos of Christianity to understand this. Christians are not allowed to charge usury. They're not allowed to charge interest one to another. But a Jew is allowed to charge interest to a Christian. And therefore, this is how the Jewish bankers began. The Jewish Jews were not only the bankers, they were also the bank. The Jews provided capital to the lords. Interest rates in medieval times were 30 to 45%. Now, that worked out very well for the Jews until the lords owed them too much money. Because when they owed them too much money, the Jews were killed, banished, their lands were taken, and 30 years later they were invited back and the process would begin again. So the Jews had to try to calibrate things very carefully. There's a misconception that Jews in medieval times were not allowed to own land. It's not true. They were allowed to own land. But very few did, because it was a very risky investment. Because any minute, you can be kicked off of your land, and it's taken, and you just lost all of your capital. So Jews could own land, but they often didn't. So the Jews were wanted. Why were they wanted? Because they were educated, because they were responsible, because they paid their taxes, because they could lend you money. And this is an interesting loophole in Christian law. A Jew is allowed to charge interest, but then the Christian would be able to take a percentage of the interest as a tax for allowing the Jew to charge interest in his land. So the Jews provided a tremendous amount of financial advantages for anyone to have, and therefore the Jews were invited. But how can the Jews be here? The Jews were invited with something called charters. A charter, or otherwise called a privilege, is basically an agreement between the Lord and the Jews, that the Lord will provide for the Jews a place to live, and most importantly, protection. Protection from who? From the serfs, from all the uneducated farmers, who are also residents on the Lord's land, but they're not getting the same conditions that the Jews are getting. The Jews are getting much better conditions. And as we can imagine, this creates a very unhealthy relationship in medieval times for the Jews. The Jews are despised by the peasants, who see them as getting more than they're getting. They're certainly more educated than them. The Jews in the Rhineland actually live at a much, much higher level than in terms of their economic means than anyone besides the lords. One last note about relationships between Jews and Christians. So the Jews were despised, but needed, until needing them became too expensive. The last relationship is that between the Jews and the Christians, meaning between the Christian leaders. Now, the lords and the peasants were also Christian at this time, but the hierarchy in Christianity, the Pope, the priests, all of the different leaders of the Christian community. So on the one hand, they despised the Jews. On the other hand, there was a very interesting Christian doctrine that had actually been created by Augustine that was called the doctrine of witnesses. The Jews, despite the fact that they were hated, it was necessary to protect them. Why? Because the Jews were the guardians of what the Christians called the Old Testament. The Christians believed that the Bible, the Torah, what they called the Old Testament, had hints in it to their Messiah. And therefore, the Jews, as the guardians and the ones who brought the Bible to the world, the Jews needed to be protected, because they also needed to be witnesses, not only to the authenticity of the Bible, of the Chumash, but also they needed to be here when the Second Coming occurred. And this is a lot of what has to do with the current relationship between the State of Israel and Christian evangelicists, because of the doctrine of the witnesses. So it's very fascinating if you think about it. The relationship that the church had with the Jews was the same one that the lords had with the Jews, which is, we need to protect you because we need you, but we don't really like you so much. And as you can imagine, this created a very challenging position for the Jews in the Rhineland area. And hopefully, as we'll have opportunities to have some other talks over the next few days, so it's very hard to come here and not speak about the Crusades and not speak about all the death and all of the suffering. So I wanted to open not speaking about that. But this really sets the stage to understand the background for the Crusades and many of the other unfortunate events in Jewish history. Before I take a question, I just wanted to add one thing about Koblenz, where we just were, because there's two very fascinating halachic discussions that take place regarding Koblenz, and one of them I'm going to talk about more in depth on Shabbos, so I'm going to save that one for now. I'm not going to discuss that one right now, but the other one is a very interesting discussion in halacha, and I'll end with this. There was a great rabbi who lived in Vienna. His name was the Or Zarua. That was the name of his work. And Rav Yitzchak Or Zarua, Rav Yitzchak ben Moshe. He died in the year, around the year 1250. He was a great posek, a great decider of Jewish law. And he was asked the following question. And this question that he was asked and his response has actually become one of the central sources in the discussion of a woman whose husband disappears. What type of testimony can be accepted in order to allow her to remarry? What we refer to as an aguna. But not an aguna in the sense of a recalcitrant husband who doesn't want to give his wife again. But a situation where the husband cannot be found and the woman is unable to get remarried. So what was the story that took place? Listen to this story. There was a war going on, a local war between lords. Again, we spoke about how the land was broken up between lords, so sometimes they fought with each other. There was a war between lords, and it's really interesting. It says in this tshuva, response to literature, it says in this tshuva that it was common for the Jews and peasants who were not involved in the war to go and watch the war. It was a spectator sport. Now, it seems to be a very dangerous spectator sport. So he writes in the tshuva that if you were careful to wear commoner clothing, so it was accepted that you're off limits. You can't be attacked if you're wearing commoner clothing. So this man, who lived in a city around, it says 5 or 10 miles away, he decides that he wants to, A, go see what's going on with the battle, but he also wants to go to Koblenz in order to do some business. So it says there that he purposely did not wear his more covering clothing, because that might be perceived as war clothing. It says that he wore, sounds like from the tshuva, what we call flip-flops. He wore very simple shoes that didn't even have backs on them, not boots that you would wear if you're going to battle. Anyway, he never showed up in Koblenz. And for a year and a half, his wife had no idea where he was. He never came home. He never made it there. She's unable to get remarried. She doesn't know what to do. Her father-in-law happens to be on business in Koblenz a little bit later. He's walking there, and it would sound a little bit suspicious if it was just him by himself, but he went with a very trusted rabbi. The two of them were going together, and while they were waiting to cross the river, they overheard two Gentiles speaking about what they had heard a year and a half ago of a Jewish man who was attacked by a gang of people right on the edge of the water, and they related how they heard him begging for his life. And the gang said to him, if we let you go, the Lord who protects the Jews is going to get us in trouble. And therefore they heard him be killed. They didn't see it. They heard the voices. They heard him screaming, and they were discussing it amongst themselves. This is what's called in halacha misiach lefi tumo, which means just simple speaking. Not because you're asking them questions, but just simple talk between themselves. So the father-in-law goes right over to the Gentiles and said, you didn't see anything? Can you identify him? What did he look like? And they said, we didn't see anything that day, but the next day I saw his body floating in the Rhine River. And he said, can you tell me anything about him? And he said, yes, he was wearing sandals. He wasn't wearing real shoes. So this was the question sent to the Or Zarua. Is this enough testimony to allow this poor woman to get married? It was the same time period. It was in the same region. There weren't other people that we know about who went missing. And he was wearing the same clothing, or at least wearing the same shoes. And the Or Zarua, after going through a lot of analysis of sources, decides that yes, this woman can get remarried, that is enough testimony to allow her to get remarried. And this tshuva, this responsa, which started all here in Kobletz, so that is has become a major source for this general discussion of women who are not able to get remarried because their husbands have disappeared. Question.